Elchim Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Elchim Talks. I'm Max Julius, Senior Investment Communications Manager. I'm delighted to be joined by Anton Issa, Chief Investment Officer at Elchim, to discuss his 2019 investment outlook. Anton, welcome to the pod.
Max, good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So in your last outlook for 2018, you talked about how as the tide of easy money from central banks went out, investors may be surprised by how many asset classes have been swimming naked, so to speak. Essentially, that structural problems associated with excess debt, deteriorating demographics, and poor productivity would come into focus and ultimately weigh on risk assets like equities. Clearly, your bearish outlook for 2018 has come to pass, unfortunately for markets. But what did you learn about the market and the macro environment from the way it actually played out?
Not a huge amount from last year, Max. I mean, I think that it's always good to have a year where your core views play out. As you say, not particularly good news for markets, but good to get the view right. So, you know, we had a pretty clearly well thought through in terms of liquidity impacting emerging market spreads, you know, firstly through the dollar channel, and then over time that kind of having a negative feedback loop on the rest of financial markets, which, you know, we saw very much in the fourth quarter of last year, where we finally saw U.S. equities and U.S. high yield really come under pressure.
It took a time for the playbook to sort of play out.
Yes,
because early in the year it didn't look quite as.
No, that's right. I mean, we did see a pretty important shock in volatility early on in the year.
Right.
But as you say, it took a long time for that theme to play out in the U.S. and that was very much a basis of the fact that, you know, strong corporate profits on the back of tax cuts in the U.S. Really meant that we had a fantastic earnings cycle in the first quarter and second quarter of last year, and the technology based narrative, you know, the performance in FANGs, for example, and that narrative was very strong in the first half of last year. So that in a way kind of offset this big liquidity theme, which was playing out very much across emerging markets for the first half of the year. Our view was, look, it was just a question of when, not if, that very much kind of came into play in the third and fourth quarter. So not a huge amount last year, I would say, that we learned. I mean, timing is always incredibly difficult in this business. I would say kind of more over the longer term, the lessons that we learn, which just keeps on being amplified and repeated, is around, you know, business cycles and more traditional way of thinking about macro is becoming, you know, largely redundant. You know, in the end, the lessons that we've all learned as investors in the last 10 years has been, it's all about credit creation. It's all about liquidity. And, last year was just once again another reminder of that to anyone who thought it was otherwise.
Right. And looking ahead to this year, do you anticipate essentially more of the same? And if so, where do you think new vulnerabilities could emerge?
Yeah. I mean, it's never the same. One great way of looking at how to play out the next year is often to look at what happened, what underperformed the year before, what outperformed the year before, and take the other side. So I don't want to extrapolate too much from last year. So in a way, there's elements of yes to that question and elements of no. So, you know, from a yes perspective, this unwinding of what has been the biggest monetary policy experiment really in the history of financial markets, and the unwind of that is very much in play. You know, we our big theme was in terms of credit creation and central bank liquidity. 2017, the numbers, we went from minus 243 in terms of net government bond supply. Last year, we went to positive 685 billion. What that means really is that government bonds are issuing debt. Central banks are buying that debt off the government, off the market. That therefore, that meant in 2017, there was actually net withdrawal of government bonds. So therefore, massive liquidity injection. Last year, they went to positive 685, which meant that actually government bonds were starting to crowd out the private sector. This year, that goes to 1.7 trillion dollars in 2019. So, you know, therefore, that tells you that this massive crowding out of the private sector in 2019 continues, you know, right. unless the Fed reverses, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
So that theme is very much still going to drive markets in 2019.
So there's a huge amount of bond supply that investors will need to digest in one way or the other.
That's correct. Yeah. And so to do that, you know, you've either got to sell other securities, sell corporate debt, sell equities, or you've got to have some natural creation of credit, which will take up that amount of supply into the system. So, you know, we have an environment whereby we are going through an exit from policy, which we have never been through. So it's very difficult to make any parallel or any historical comparisons. You must take the opposite of what it created in the first place. And Bernanke wrote the piece 7 or 8 years ago in The Wall Street Journal, which was simply around QE2 and justifying QE2 being about, look, in the end, if we inflate asset prices or if we support asset prices, it has what he called the portfolio impact effect along those lines,
yep.
which ultimately meant that you inflated asset prices, higher asset prices meant that everyone felt better, you created more of a wealth effect, and that impacted the economy. You know, that was his article. Well, the opposite happens, right? If in the end you're going through a process of selling securities, then you have an opposite impact on financial assets, you have an opposite impact on the wealth of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's very hard to kind of make, firm conclusions on this, but it feels like we are going to go through that process of repricing.
Right. So you've talked about this portfolio effect going into reverse, and the focus of that being in credit markets this year. Could you perhaps expand a bit on what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to the point I made at the beginning around, you know, macro being very much around credit and liquidity, to say we're at the end of a cycle is almost not a great way to explain it. We're at the end of a credit cycle and a liquidity cycle. You know, we've seen a pretty decent move in some investment grade spreads, to a certain extent investment grade, et cetera. So what you're starting to see is really the cost of capital is going up, right? And that is going to lead to a number of the companies who have levered up during this cycle, who are, you know, perhaps more exposed to, you know, technology disruption, and hence their business models are becoming slightly more redundant. This kind of longer term theme around technology disruption, and effectively, you know, organic revenue growth has been pretty poor. And what they've used is, you know, financial tools to lever up, cheap borrowing, M&A share buybacks we're truly through record levels there. So that kind of financial engineering to kind of hide really what's a pretty, pretty weak business model. Now that we get, you know, cost of capital is going up, then clearly the obvious thing to happen here is that as spreads go up, financing becomes more difficult, and those companies battle to access credit. So we are at the beginning of a pretty decent default cycle. Sure, that will happen in sub-investment grade. But the investment grade market, you know, 50% of the investment grade market now is BBB, which is one notch above sub-investment grade, compared to 35% 7 or 8 years ago, compared to 25% 15 years ago. So, you know, we already have an investment grade market that through this whole cycle has been, you know, deteriorating credit quality. And, you know, we will see a number of the much larger traditional type of old school economy companies come under a fairly large amount of pressure in 2019. We're really starting to see that at the end of last year. So that's the big theme for this year, as this kind of evolves to something which is around corporate credit defaults. And you start to see something more similar, nothing's the same, but more similar to the 2001 recession type cycle, which is more on corporate credit, less on financials. And so that's
versus 2008.
Look, the negative feedback loop and how that impacts the system and how that impacts government bond issuance and banks, etc., is and insurance companies and pension funds is going to be the next leg of that. But the first point is around, you know, deteriorating growth and increased cost of capital and impact on corporate bond spreads and et cetera, in terms of defaults. So,
right.
That's very much our 2019 roadmap for the year.
So I think it would be fair to say that there's probably more pain to come then for markets, even though they have stabilised a little of late, and leading some people to wonder whether now is the time to buy the dip. Mm-hmm. Although I imagine, given your last comments, you don't think that's the case. But I mean, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, we had our macro discussion yesterday as a team. You know, we all gathered round and went through this exact debate. And timing is always the most tricky one. And the overriding view that we all have across all the desks is that kind of medium term end of credit cycle structural view is absolutely the theme for 2019. But most members of this team believe it's more of a back end of 2019. And to your point, you know, we had real signs from the Federal Reserve around stepping back around hiking rates in March, which is now becoming a very low probability event. Even talking around potentially kind of taking their foot off the gas in terms of quantitative tightening towards the end of the year. And hence we've seen a pretty decent bounce in financial assets. You know, market was pretty oversold. So absolutely, you know, we can see a rally. How long that rally lasts is questionable. You know, the view is very much comparing this to 2016, which we wrote about in our piece. There's a lot of differences between now and 2016, which we can talk about. So the brevity, the length of this rally, in my view, is limited, but it can go on for a few months.
Right. Having also read the piece, I know that some of those differences are about the central bank policy response.
Yes, yes.
And so, exactly as you mentioned, the Fed has changed its tone a bit, and markets are definitely pricing a different rates trajectory from the US central bank. But what do you think needs to happen to trigger a significant policy response?
When we say significant, we have to be clear on what we mean by significant. Let's just be very specific and talk about the Federal Reserve. So significant would be one or two or both things, i.e., you know, they would have to effectively reverse quantitative tightening and cut rates, not just simply keep rates where they are. And even then, well, they need to go even further. So let's use that as a scenario just to define significant in terms of what their response would be. For that to happen, you know, you really have to be at the point where a recession is starting to become a base case view of financial markets. And, you know, the reason why it's different between now and what happened in 2016 is back in 2016 when Janet Yellen, you know, stood up in the middle of February that year and effectively talked down the dollar and started to talk about things like negative rates, et cetera, was the unemployment rate was above target. You know, it was 5.8%, I think, something at the time, compared to 3.7 now. You had core PCE, which is the, you know, important inflation target, you know, just above 1, whereas it's kind of close to 2 now. Very different environment. And then most importantly, you had the ECB, who was all in. Right now, the ECB is legally at their limit.
The European Central Bank.
That's correct. Yeah. They're at their limit. They've ended QE. And, you know, for them to change that would require, you know, legal change, which they've done in the past. But with Draghi in his last, Mario Draghi, the you know, the head of the ECB, in his last few months has had, the likelihood of that happening is very low. So bringing it back to your question, which is how far the bar is away from them doing something, I think it's far away, and that a lot will have to happen in terms of financial markets going down even a lot mm-hmm. further, in terms of economic recession becoming a base case before they would aggressively change course. So that tells you that although the markets are feeling a bit better here, that the potential move down is still substantially further before they really change course dramatically.
Right. So essentially, there's a lot less scope for central banks to act now than there was.
The Fed has more scope because they, you know, rates are 2.5, not a quarter. All right, so you know, you could say they've got more tools there. They are doing QT, so they could stop QT. So in that way, the Federal Reserve has more scope. Mm. ECB has nothing really. You know, extreme statement. They could say they could do more TLTROs. There's more they could do, but it's limited.
Liquidity operations. Yeah, and it's essentially bought as many bunds, so German government bonds, as it can.
It's at that point. So the scope for them to do more is very limited. So, yeah. And I think the other point to make is fiscal policy, which... as much as the tax cuts are something which people have been pretty happy about, to enact tax cuts at this stage of the cycle and to effectively, increase the deficit we've never seen anything like this happen, I can recall. So the ability for the government to provide support is limited. I'm not saying that they can't. You also have a pretty dysfunctional set up there in terms of them being able to be kind of coordinated to provide some kind of response. Fiscal and monetary are at the point whereby their ability to support the economy, to support financial markets, is just a lot more difficult than it was 3 years ago. I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's just more difficult. So hence the comparable, I think, is not the right one.
Right. We've talked about your base case view for markets and the macro environment this year. How do you think that will impact key asset classes going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty obvious statement to make that means the pressure on corporate credit spreads will continue. We may have a reprieve, we are having a reprieve, and it could continue for a few months. But over the course of the year, as we get into the back end of this year, you expect that to continue. As an example, U.S. credit is currently about 150 basis points over treasuries. Going into a typical recession, to be defined, it gets to around kind of 235 or so. So there's, we're a long way away from that type of level. And if you believe that there's a higher probability of U.S. recession coming in 2020, then there's it's only one way, which is wider over the course of a year. Volatility, is picked up. Yeah, I mean, without central bank support, volatility will remain both ways.
Equities
is look. There's some parts of the equity market which are become incredibly cheap for a long term investor. Talking to our equity team and going through individual companies which are trading at some of them high single digit PEs with dividend yields also kind of north of 5%. You start to kind of, and if you believe this is a sustainable company which is going to play out well for the long term themes, you buy that and you put them in the bottom drawer and you hold on to it and you add to it as the markets go down. So the difference between now and a year ago is there's real opportunity across markets to find really high quality companies trading at pretty attractive entry levels. On the whole, however, if you take, let's say, the U.S. equity market, which I know is much more inflated than other asset prices, the cyclical adjusted PE is still close to 30. And that at that level, based on historic analysis, your 10-year return expectations for U.S. equities is low single-digit percentages. And with where we are in the cycle, that tells you that it's down before it goes back up again. So I would say that equities depending on your time frame, you don't want to catch the falling knife. That's all. So.
Interesting. Couple of other asset classes I'd mention. There have been a lot of concerns about China, mm-hmm. and obviously those have weighed in part on emerging market assets. So I'd be interested to hear what's your view on those, as well as the dollar, given what you've said about the Fed and UK assets.
Well, I'll start with the dollar, because everything that matters in the world is related to what your view is on the dollar. It really is a key kind of call. Over the short term, I can see the argument for a weaker dollar. Given the kind of change in sentiment coming from the Fed, fine, you can see a weaker dollar over the short term. Over the medium term, i.e. 12 months out, given what we've just discussed, Max, you can only believe one way in terms of that the dollar will appreciate over the next 12 months. We're in a dollar bull market for lots of reasons, and our fundamental view has always been that. And dollar will be stronger, by year end against emerging market currencies and most currencies. So Then that kind of links you to emerging markets, which, as I said earlier, there's some real value starting to emerge. I mean, if you look at growth dynamics in emerging markets long term, they're much more attractive than developed markets. Typically, portfolios are underweight on an absolute basis relative to emerging market equities compared to developed market equities. If you think about the percentage of growth now in emerging markets. So the long-term narrative around emerging markets actually is starting to look really, really good. The problem is timing. And if you are a longer-term investor, adding to emerging market equities over the course of this year seems like a pretty sensible thing to do, but recognize there's a higher probability of them continuing to go lower. So it's not an exact answer to your question, but I would say that I can see the long-term value now in emerging market equities. There probably will be even more better entry points. Timing is tricky. UK, I don't have any particular insight on Brexit. I would say that from a pure valuations perspective, UK equities clearly look incredibly cheap versus other developed market equities. And everyone is pretty underweight UK equities. Everyone's pretty bearish the UK. So without having any fundamental view on how Brexit plays out, I could see why one would take the other side of that. So UK equities, not credit, that's a different story. But UK equities are on a relative basis a buy over a longer term.
Thank you. Well, we've discussed your base case and how that might impact various asset classes and markets. What tail risks do you see?
Yeah. I think the thing that what we haven't discussed is Europe, I think when we talk about tail risks, I think we should talk about what is it that the market doesn't quite now have as their year ahead consensus view. So tail risk would be, the tail risk means different things to different people. Just to define it would be that what is the factor in the market right now which is not priced in at all and expectations over the course of the year? And I would say that a return to European crisis type policy, we saw a significant widening in Italian spreads, but not a crisis.
There wasn't as much contagion.
That's exactly right, and that's QE really, which kept the Italian crisis away from the rest of Europe,
Spain, etc.
Yeah. So I think just in terms of a tail risk, I would put that out there. Is that are we in 5 or 6 months' time in an environment whereby senior financials are trading at hundreds over, and we have a proper bank equity crisis in Europe? You have some big banks under pressure. You have countries like France, their spreads related to the bunds are trading significantly wider, and the whole European type of the whole euro type of fragility, which we've talked about for so many years, kind of becoming a core theme. And I think there's two elements why that could happen. Number one is ECB is constrained. And number two is, if you go to the comments around the economic growth weakness and as we approach the end of the cycle in terms of the economy, then that could put pressure on the European narrative. So that would be a kind of a tail risk that I would put out there.
Okay, and to tie everything together, what does all of this mean for the way we manage money for our clients?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing for us as a firm, and it's something which we have worked really hard on over the last 10 years, is to do two really important things. Number one is to ensure that the way we manage money is about what the outcome our clients are trying to achieve, right? And most of our clients, almost pretty much all of them, have long-term objectives. They're either trying to match 30-year liabilities for a corporate pension fund, or they're a client invest in a DC scheme, which is saving for retirement in 25, 30 years' time, saving for their child's university via our retail business. So it's all pretty long-term. The FTSE in the next 3 months is not that relevant. So, you know, reason why we introduce long themes or we think so hard about the longer term issues is actually the best way to capture value is by thinking long term. So first, to your point, is continuing to emphasize, okay, we need to make money over the short term, but really, what are our long term themes? So that very much remains the case. And then the second one is, if our view is correct here in terms of we're reaching a point now in the corporate credit cycle where defaults are picking up, the focus is on capital preservation and on avoiding defaults. And a large portion of our book is in investment grade credit, and hence, you know, ensuring that we are very, very particular around which companies we own and exiting positions, and recognizing that defaults are kind of very much part of the kind of the thesis the next 12 to 24 months. So those would be the two things in terms of impact on our investment process.
Right. Well, I think that's quite a reassuring message to end up on, that despite the risks you've outlined, there are concrete measures we can take to try and mitigate them, and perhaps even to take advantage of some of the opportunities that are also presented. Anton Issa, thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To find out more, visit LGIM.com.
Great. Thank you, Max.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.